Welcome to another episode of the 100K Freelancer Club podcast. In this episode, we dive deep into the art and science of value-based pricing with the incredible Jonathan Stark. As a freelancer, understanding how to price your services is pivotal to not just surviving, but thriving in the competitive freelance marketplace. Today, Jonathan, a seasoned expert in value pricing, joins us to unravel the mysteries of moving away from the time for money trap towards the rewarding value-based pricing model. In this episode, you'll learn the fundamental flaws of hourly billing and how it limits your potential growth, Jonathan's journey from recognizing the pitfalls of traditional pricing models to embracing and advocating for value pricing, practical strategies to transition from hourly rates to value-based pricing, even as a beginner freelancer. You'll learn the art of the why conversation, how to engage clients in discussion that reveal the true value of your work beyond the hours spent. You'll also learn how to structure your offerings to align your incentives with those of your clients, leading to better outcomes and higher satisfaction for both parties, and the potential of performance-based pricing models and how to approach them without risking your financial stability. Jonathan's insights are not just theoretical, they're backed by years of experience and success in the field. By the end of this episode, you'll have a clear roadmap to elevate your freelance business through strategic pricing, ensuring you're compensated fairly for the value that you deliver. So, whether you're just starting out or looking to revamp your pricing strategy, this episode is packed with invaluable lessons to help you make that pivotal shift. Join us as we explore how to break free from the hourly billing cycle and step into a more profitable, value-driven freelance career. But before we dive right into this episode, we would love it if you could hit that subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening to this podcast, as it would really help us out and we can continue to bring you great conversations with great guests. Let's dive right in. A massive thank you, Jonathan, for coming on the podcast today, and welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for the invite. I appreciate it.
Oh, that's all right. I've been listening to your podcast and researching you throughout this week. So I've got a list of questions that I'm excited to dive into, because I think me and you, we share a common theme, and that is that we don't like hourly pricing. And I can see from your content and from your website that you are a massive advocate of value-based pricing, which we'll dive into later in this podcast. But I first just want to dive into a bit about yourself, a bit about, you know, your history and origin story as to how you got started. So from my notes, you're a software developer, consultant, and trainer for over 15 years, working with some major brands like T-Mobile, Cisco, and Intel. Do love Intel. And then you transitioned into a freelance role. So just walk me through that origin story. How did you come to be the Jonathan that you are today?
Yeah, so I'm pretty old, so I've had a few different kind of decade-long periods of my life. I graduated with a music degree in the early 90s and moved into graphic design and desktop publishing, and just got more and more into computers after that. But the period that you're talking about is specifically in the early 2000s. I was a FileMaker developer, and I worked at a small firm, about 10 employees, 10 other developers, and I was promoted from being a developer to being the vice president. And at that point, I got access to, you know, I was doing one-on-ones with people, and I got access to people's salaries. I knew how much everyone was making. And I realized at that point that we weren't making that much money on our best developer, and we were making a lot more money on our most junior developer, because the best developer was really fast and good, and the junior developer was really slow and needed to do things two and three times. And we billed them out at the same rate, and I couldn't get my head around that. I thought, like, geez, if we were going to hire a bunch of people, we'd find a bunch of bad developers and grow the agency like that. It seemed insanity. So I puzzled about that for quite a while, trying to sort of convince myself that our best developers important and worth the money we pay him because he can train the other developers. And then I was like, well, no, because then they're just going to get faster and we're going to make less money from them. So eventually it occurred to me that hourly billing was the problem. And if we'd switched to some kind of fixed project rates, then our best developer would be by far our most profitable developer. So the financial incentives would be aligned and it would make sense to go out and get the best possible developers we could get, because the more quickly they could churn out like really high quality solutions, then, you know, the more we get paid. So it never would have occurred to me if I hadn't seen the compensation for the different employees. And, you know, I'm actually shortening a much longer story, but that's how I ended up realizing that hourly billing was nuts. And I went to the boss and I told him what I just told you. And he said, okay, I get what you're saying in theory, but what would we do to change to that, to some other model? What other model would we even change to? And I had no idea. I had just, you know, seen the light that hourly billing was the wrong way to do things, and went off on my own to figure out what the right way was, because I didn't want to risk tanking the firm, you know, trying experimenting on our business model with 10 people's mortgages on the line. So I went solo and tried to figure it out. And the very first year, it was just massively successful. I stumbled across a book called Value-Based Fees by Alan Weiss, and that was my Bible for like 3 years. I advocate other kinds of pricing now besides value-based. There are other ways, but none of them are trading time for money. That's the hourly rate is just absolute cancer on any professional services business.
Yeah, because I guess it penalizes efficiency.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, I guess the problem with the hourly rate is because it like penalizes your efficiency, right? And even if, you know, you are a freelancer on that rate, it doesn't necessarily encourage you to do the best work as fast as possible. Because if you know, if you steam through it, get it done really quick, then you're not going to be able to bill as much. And especially if you're on platforms like Upwork.com, where they track your hours if you go into like hourly rates contracts, it seems like a bit anti-intuitive. Because, well, when I hire freelancers anyway, because most of the time on there you have to hire is like or they'll come through as an hourly rate, and somebody will say, okay, this is going to take me 16 hours a week for the next month, and they will bill you 16 hours on the dot, even though they may have done less than that. And then it brings up like arguments and stuff like that as well. Like, did you really work 16 hours? When really, it doesn't matter if they work 16 hours or 30 seconds, as long as you got what you wanted. Like, as long as you reach the objective. So, like, I'm with you. I'm totally with you on that side of things. But when you switched to go solo, it mentions, or I can see from your profile that you doubled your own income just in 1 year from switching from that hourly billing to sort of that value pricing. How do you think, like, can you just explain the process of how that happened for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit apples to apples because we're talking about salary versus, you know, like revenue, but still it was a dramatic improvement in terms of my income and my quality of life, because all of the things that you just mentioned about, you know, wondering if they really did the work, and all of those things that come with the client relationship when you're billing by the hour, all of that stuff went away. So if something took me longer, for example, if something took me longer than I expected, the client didn't care. It didn't cost them anymore. And, you know, in most cases, there was no hard deadline for anything. So it was just so relaxing compared to my life, you know, weeks or months before, where I was tracking every hour. I was chasing 10 developers to get all their hours in. I was fighting about hours entries with clients because why did this take so long to do the database backup this week? And last week it took half as long. It was just fighting about the wrong thing, fighting first of all, and about the wrong thing on top of it. So it was just so much more relaxing, and the client relationships were instantly way better. So that was one thing. The other thing was, yeah, I made way more money. So because at the time I was doing FileMaker development and some PHP. This is like 2006, and I was pretty good at it. I was really fast. I had an approach I would use that was very pragmatic, and I could just crank things out really quickly. And I was also pretty good at uncovering, you know, what the client wanted. It was like good at uncovering the scope of things and what was going to satisfy them, what kind of outcomes they were looking for. So I would just crush through things. You know, up front, I'd talk to the client and I'd give them a price, you know, like maybe it'll be 16 hours and my rate's $150 an hour. Maybe it'll be, I don't know, maybe it'll be 40. I don't know. It's going to take a while. None of that. It was like, it will be $50,000. Or it will be $5,000, or it will be $150,000. That's how much it's going to be. And if it takes me longer, that's my problem. That's on me. And clients love that because it's great that you have hired freelancers before and you know what it feels like to have that meter running in the background with no idea of, you know, how many hours they're working or if they're really, you know, it drives you crazy. It can drive you crazy. Clients don't like it. So when I switched to this, I had no problem. I didn't have to convince the clients. They were like, you're going to give us a price, like an actual price. And I was like, yeah, is that acceptable? And they're like, yeah. since I wasn't selling my time, there's this one thing I used to do. You could just make so much money. It's like, if you're good at what you do and you can satisfy the client very quickly, it would be nuts to provide an hourly rate. Like the better you get, the less you make. So switching, I feel like I'm patting myself on the back here, but I was pretty good at what I did. And if you're listening to this and you're pretty good at what you do, you can probably just promise outcomes, set a price for the outcome, and the client will be like, yeah, let me know when you're done. Sounds great. So you can do, we can start talking numbers, I suppose, but if you're fast, if you're starting to feel like, geez, I'm really good and I'm getting undercut by new freelancers or people who are not as good as me, even if you're new too, like people who aren't as good as me, but I'm losing jobs to them because their hourly rate is lower, then it might be time for you to think about giving some kind of fixed price. And like I said, there's more ways to do it than just value pricing, but any kind of fixed price is better than hourly in terms of profitability.
Yeah. Do you think it's still a suitable method for beginner freelancers though? And I say that because if you're a beginner freelancer and you're sort of still building upon your craft, you're still like becoming an expert in that certain skill, whether that's development in PHP or that's graphic design or whatever, it may be more difficult to predict potential problems that could extend the project. It may be difficult to accurately predict the time it's going to take. So is it something that you can, is it a pricing method that you can use as a beginner in a given field?
If we're talking about value-based pricing, value pricing specifically, and you're new to what you do, you're new to running a business, you aren't comfortable doing sales, you know, you're not comfortable having client conversations around price, it's going to be pretty, it's a lot to learn. So like, let's say you're a copywriter and you're pretty good at that. You're new, you like it, you think you're pretty good at it. You got a sort of a, let's say, middle of the road rate. Hopefully it's not by the word, but whatever your rate is, If you also are very new to all the other things that are important to running your business or a business, then that's a ton of stuff to learn all at once. Like, you're still getting better at your craft. You also have to learn how to do marketing, sales, you know, how to do sales conversations, how to write a proposal, all of these things that are handled by a platform like Upwork. You don't have to really think about any of that stuff. A platform like Upwork is taking advantage of the fact that you don't know how to do all of that stuff. So what I would say is, if you're a freelancer, you're essentially an entrepreneur, whether you know it or not, whether you think like that or not. So in addition to learning your craft, you need to learn the business stuff too. You know, so that means marketing, sales, all the stuff I listed. So that's a lot to chew. That's a lot to bite off all at once. So value pricing is probably, it's kind of a black belt move. You really need to understand your clients. You really need to understand what they value, not what you value. You have to understand what the outcomes are that this white paper or this marketing campaign that you're writing for them, you need to understand what the outcomes are that they're looking for, how they see your contribution to that. So it's pretty hard at the beginning to do all of that at once. That said, you can start with something like a productized service or an all-you-can-eat subscription model. There are other ways to set a price besides using hours that someone who's new definitely could do. So if you're sort of brand new to this, and let's say you're a copywriter, you could do an all-you-can-eat subscription where you sign up 10 different clients and they can submit requests to you on some basis that is going to control the scope enough for you to not get killed, you know, not be working 80 hours a week for 10 clients, and have that regular recurring revenue, monthly revenue. And as long as you keep them satisfied and they don't churn out, you would have separated your time from your money. So that the faster you get, the better you get, the more profit you're going to get. It's critically important that at some point, sooner hopefully than later, you separate your time from your money, because it'll flip everything in your head. All of a sudden you'll be like, wow, I thought I was efficient before, but who boy am I efficient now?
Mm.
Or talking clients out of doing gigantic projects, talking them into small phased engagements. You generally wouldn't do that if you're billing by the hour. By the hour, you want the project to be bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, so you're doing it forever and the meter is running. You don't want that when it's the other way around, because that's taking too much risk. You want things to be smaller. You want to be efficient. You want to be like lean and light and just like hit these sort of targeted home runs for the client. Those are the high value things for them. And then so you can work a lot less and make the same money, or you can work the same and make more money. But jumping straight for a new person who is still figuring things out, their craft out, jumping straight to value pricing is usually pretty hard. I've met a few people who just naturally get it. They're natural salespeople, but most people don't. Most people really have to wrap their heads around it and need a couple of years of experience dealing with clients before they really can start to do a good job of it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the only use cases I've really seen of a non-hourly rate for beginners is on platforms like Fiverr, where they offer specific packages.
Right.
So 4-page website, up to this, and they define everything in the offering of like the maximums and 1,000 euros or whatever that price may be, which is, again, quite a good way to get started. But talking more again on the value pricing, so
mm-hmm.
once you do get to a position of where you are able to implement that form of pricing strategy, and when it is actually going to be, you know, most beneficial to you, what are the actual challenges to implementing that pricing strategy?
Okay, so I'll describe what it is first, and then I'll point out where it's difficult for people, where they usually get tripped up. But the concept of value pricing is setting a price based on the value to the client instead of the cost to you. So most people, when they go into their first fixed price type of thing, if it's a project, they'll talk to the client, they'll try and uncover all of the scope, you know, how many pages does the white paper have to be, how many emails in the marketing sequence, blah, 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 blah. And they'll try and uncover all of that, and they'll think, this will probably take me about 100 hours. They'll multiply the 100 hours by whatever their current hourly rate is, maybe tack on 15% on top of that just in case, and then they'll present that as a fixed price to the client. That's thinking about your costs first. So your cost as the employer of yourself, that the time that you're going to put in, that's a cost. You're setting a price based on a cost. Value-based is the other way around. So the value-based, you with a value-based approach, at the beginning, when you first meet a client, they're probably going to talk about scope a little bit, and that's fine. You can write that down. But you need to get them talking about why they would hire someone like you to do this. Why do this project at all? Why not do it? What's the big deal? Why hire someone expensive like me to do it when you could just do it yourself? You've got Microsoft Word. Why don't you just type it up? You've got access to your WordPress installation. Why don't you just make the website? You know, and you get all these reasons from them. Why is this important to do now? Is there something that changed? Is there something urgent? Or is this a nice to have that you could do anytime the next 18 months? So if you kind of try and talk them out of the project, talk them out of hiring you, talk them out of doing it right now, they'll be forced to convince you why they should hire you. So it flips everything 180 degrees. So instead of talking about scope first, you talk about scope last. So when you're walking through this conversation, I call it the why conversation. This is pretty tricky for people starting out. This is probably the trickiest piece because they're used to pitching. They're used to saying, no, I'm the best. I'm better than these other people. My hourly rate's justified because I've got 3 years of experience and yada, 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 yada. It's a beauty contest. Like pick me, pick me, pick me. My approach requires that you do not do that. You cannot do that. You have to have them convince you that this is a good idea, the thing that they want you to do. You want to understand the business case. So if somebody came to me and said, hey, we heard you're a good writer. My friend Alice told me that you did some white papers for her. Could you do some white papers for me? And I'd be like, yeah, I'd love to do that. I mean, I can do that, sure. But why do you want them? What's the point? Once I deliver them to you, what are you going to do with them? What's going to happen next? Oh, we're going to put them behind a squeeze page on our website. Oh, what are you trying to attract? Email subscribers? Like what kind of subscribers are you trying to attract? What happens to them next? And like talking to them like a business owner and not just like someone who is being paid to type and figure out what the benefit is. Are they trying to attract leads for a B2B enterprise sale? Or is the white paper to, I don't know, position their CTO as a thought leader so they can attract more employees? Like, what is the point of the white paper? And then, so they might tell you the point, and you might say, you know, I could do these white papers for you, but I could do something I think would be even more effective to achieve that outcome, like maybe write a different kind of lead magnet or something completely different to get them in some magazine, you know, who knows, whatever your skill sets are. So there might be a different way to achieve the outcome that you as the expert are aware of that the client's not even aware of. They might have just heard that white papers sometimes result in the thing that they want, so they asked you for a white paper. So by the time you get to the end of this why conversation, if it's going to be a good fit, you will be convinced that you can contribute to the outcome that this client is looking for. You know, we want our CTO to be perceived as a thought leader. It's like, okay, I can contribute to that outcome. And so you're convinced, they have convinced themselves that they do need to hire you. And then so you can say, all right, I'm going to crunch some numbers. I'm going to, sort of go back to my office. I'm going to crunch some numbers. I can think of probably three different ways that I could contribute to this outcome that you're looking for. Would it be okay if I get a proposal to you on Wednesday? And they'll say, sure. So then you go back and you, based on the conversation, the business case that they made, you can guesstimate a value if they didn't even tell you outright. Sometimes they will, not usually, but you can pretty much, you know, back of the napkin calculation, like, this is probably worth a lot of money to them. This is probably not worth a lot of money to them. You can figure it out. And then you set some prices based on what it would be worth to them instead of how long you think it's going to take you to do, because you haven't even decided what you're going to do yet. First, you find the value with the why conversation. Then you say, okay, for round numbers, I'll say, this is probably worth $100,000 to a person like this at a company like this at a time like this. It's probably worth about $100,000. The outcome, not the white papers. So if the outcome is probably worth $100,000 for their CTO to be perceived in the industry as a thought leader and all of the things that will do for recruiting, then okay, so let me set some prices based on that guesstimated value. It's more, it's part art, part science. So you've figured out, okay, 100 grand. So I'm gonna pick three prices based on that. I still haven't decided what I'm gonna do. So I just say $10,000, $22,000, and $50,000. So a fraction of the value. So now you have set three prices. Then and only then, you decide what you could do for the client to contribute to that outcome at that budget, at that price that you set for yourself. So you look at the 10,000 and you say, I could do a white paper. I could do two white papers and a squeeze page and a funnel or a nurture campaign. I could do that for 10 grand. I'd be super happy to do that for 10 grand. And then you could say, what would I do for 22 grand? If they were going to give me 22 grand, what could I do? Well, I could, and after it was done, I could send the white paper to a bunch of people in the industry. I could try and submit the CTO some kind of piece. I could write some thought piece that led to the white paper that we could then pitch to Forbes and other magazines where I would get it on Hacker News or something. And if they're going to give me $50,000, what could I do? And then you just keep adding on sort of benefits that would contribute to the outcome potentially. And then when you present that to the client, now that we've got three options to pick from and they're benefits focused, like the benefits of this, of option one are X, Y, and Z. The benefits of option two are everything from one plus A, B, and C. And then three, the Mercedes option, you get all of those six benefits from the previous two options plus, 6 months of, whatever the benefits of the top option are.
Mm.
And so then they're making a decision about like how best to work with you, not like whether or not they should work with you. So in those sense, they will feel that you are taking the risk with them because it's a fixed price. And if it takes you longer than you expected, that's on you. That's your problem. So the financial incentives are aligned. You're focusing on benefits. And by offering three options, it gives them something to compare your price to other than other people. So they don't have to go, if you just give them one price, they're gonna look around and be like, well, I don't know if this is a good price or not. So how do you find out? You look for comps. You look for other people that do the same thing. And you think, oh, I could maybe get this, like this price is really high. I could get a whole bunch of people for half of this. So what's the justification of this really high one? If you give them three options, then they're less likely to shop around and just be like, well, these all sound great. That 50,000 one, that's more than we were hoping to spend. But the first option sounds great. That's a slam dunk. And the second one, maybe we should go for the second one, right? So now they're thinking about which way is best to work with you instead of whether or not to work with you. So I could keep going forever. But the really, really tricky part, and it even took me understanding all of this stuff, it took me probably 12 to 18 months to really break my old habits and have that scope last the why conversation in the sales interview. It took me a long time to break the habit of trying to uncover scope in the meeting. It was a really hard habit to break. And I think, so if you were asking like, what are the hard parts, that right there is the tricky part.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting because I think in my personal experience, I've naturally come to talking about the why, and I'll get to that in a second. But what I've never done is broken down into packages based on scope for the client. And even though you're saying that now, that is such a fantastic idea to stop them shopping around. It's the same as like in e-commerce when you have the bundle option. Like if you've got a pair of Nike shoes for $90, they're going to look on Amazon, they're going to look on here, and they're just going to buy whatever's the cheapest. But if you bundle it up with Nike shoes, socks, and something else, they can't be bothered to look around for all three of those individual products. And it's like this psychological, like the value of the bundle, and it stops that. So that's that same like e-commerce technique that you're applying into like basically, business strategy there. And yeah, that's a fantastic piece of advice there. And then on the why section, I've found myself doing exactly what you've said, but on accident. So basically the way client acquisition and these types of meetings
go for me is I never want to do the work. There's always clients coming to me, but I don't necessarily want the clients because I'm busy. So I'm always, and it always ends up as me, as them pitching to me. So they pitch to me an idea. Right. Oh, we want this website to do this and that. And I'm like, okay, but why? And they're like, oh, we want to do this. Well, that's not going to work. I can tell you now. Okay, the why won't it work? And then I always, it ends up almost like a free consultation for like an hour is to like, okay, but why do you want this? Why do you want that? Like, your outcome is not to be on 7 social media platforms. Your outcome is to sell $1 million worth of that stock you got.
Yes,
so,
precisely. Yes, you've completely nailed it. Yes.
And I think these things I've been doing just without realizing it. So like you've actually like verbalized it and sort of like put it into a light of like, where if I just had like a light bulb moment, it's like, oh damn, yeah, that maybe that is why I have such a high close rate, because I'm doing these tactics.
Of course. Yes.
Yeah. I'm doing these
it's
tactics.
No coincidence.
Yeah, that you're describing right there. And I think I always thought in my mind my high close rate was because I didn't have that smell of desperation. Like, I don't want to work
that
with the
too.
Client. They want to work with me. But I also think it's like what you said there. Like, I'm scoping it out. I'm trying to understand what value I can bring and whether it's worth my time. Because I think something I heard on your last podcast is something that I resonate with a lot. And it's that you say, I don't like money. I like time. And so you're saying that, like, I work for 5 hours a week in the average, if you were to calculate it by hour, it's like $1,500 an hour. And I was like, yes, that is, right. I think that is exactly what a lot of freelancers want to go for. And I think when you can get into everything that you've just been talking about there, like, yeah, it's like, it really starts to fire. But how, can you dive into a little bit more of how a freelancer, let's just say, you've got your skills kind of nailed. This year, you're a copywriter. You've made 50 grand last year. You've been working on hourly, and now you're transitioning to value-based pricing. And I would always, for me, one thing I try and advocate is, I'll get your opinion on this first, actually, is commission-based pricing. So if you write the advertisement copy for an advert that's going out on social media, a Twitter ad, for example, and that Twitter ad generates $1 million worth of revenue, can I get 1% of that, of those sales? Because that is like obviously a part of the value you've generated. Is that, do you recommend that form of pricing to anybody?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's even closer to the outcome that they're looking for. So you're partnering even more closely with them. You're putting skin in the game, which is, it's usually too risky. It feels too risky to people. It usually feels too risky to say like, yeah, I'll work on this ad campaign for free for however long it takes but I'll take 1% of whatever sales you make. That can be pretty risky, but guess what? With a lot of risk can come a lot of reward. And I do know people who have done extremely well with this kind of an approach where they'll take equity in a startup or something like that. For me, that was always more risky than it was just more risky than I wanted. I didn't want to like have to see somebody's books. Cause like, how do you even find out this information? You know, like the client would need to show you. And it was never for me, but it's definitely an approach. So if you are real, you know, like look at lawyers who are like, you win or it's free. You know, it's like, you know, personal injury lawyers that are like, yeah, just come to me. We'll do the case. I'll decide whether or not I think we can win. And if we can, I'll do the case. And then I'll take 30% of the settlement, you know, but if they lose, no fee. So yeah, it's totally a model. And think of as a buyer, it's pretty attractive because if I win as the client, you win. If you win, I win. It's totally a win-win. But you need to be able to afford to do it. You know, you need, because it's not always going to work. So you have to have enough business, or you need to be so good, so certain that, you know, you're not going to ruin your cash flow. You're not going to put yourself in a bad cash flow situation. So maybe in theory, you could do something like, let's say you do, like you said, paid ads. Let's say you're a paid ads person or conversion rate optimization person, or maybe even an SEO person. And you're so confident that you're going to hit a home run, then you could probably get quite a few clients just by letting people know that it's a performance. It's like a performance fee. So or commission. I wouldn't say commission, but anyway, whatever the word is, it's like, if you don't get what you want, I don't get paid. So tell me what you want. Well, we want X. We want this increase in sales. It's been Y for a long time. We want it to be, I don't know, go up 20%. You're like, and you look at the situation, you're like, yeah, I'm very sure that I can do that. So you basically place a bet. You say, yep, I'll do that for you. In your head, you're going to think about how long it might take, and what the outcome might be. So the thing about that that might not be obvious to people, maybe it's obvious, maybe it's not, is that a lot of times you don't have a direct impact on the revenue numbers. So for example, you know, you used if you were running paid ads for a pair of sneakers, that's pretty close to the money. Like, you have a pretty solid control over the money faucet that you can turn on and turn off. But if you're like a branding person, or you do like 3D renderings, 3D animations of like product animations, those sorts of things, you're pretty far away from the money. So to commit to, you know, I'm going to do this 3D animation that you're going to run as a 30-second social media ad, and I'm going to do it for free. And if that, you know, and if your sales go up, I get 1%. So you do all this work, and then the company closes because of some fiscal irresponsibility of the CFO, or the CEO gets ousted from some scandal. I mean, so many other things can happen when you're far away from the money that it gets increasingly risky. Like, you could do a great job and them never post the ad. Like, let's say you make this amazing ad and they're like, oh, we ran out of money. We have to spend the next 6 months trying to raise another round of funding, and we're going to hold off on that ad campaign until then. So maybe someday in the future, if we get funded, then we'll run that ad that you made for us for free. And then maybe if there's some uptick in sales. It's just, to me, it was, the farther you get away from the money, the less interest I would have in some kind of commission or performance bonus or performance fee or anything like that.
Yeah, that's so true.
Something to keep in mind. You don't have control over the whole thing.
Yeah, this is why I love speaking to other people, because in my work, I am close to the money. I'm always, like, my main focus is really return on investment. So I'm right there on the front of it. So I'm always advocating to people, you know, these are great deals. Like, you should always put yourself in a position where you can at least find and track the impact that you've had on a business. By, you know, requesting access to certain analytics tools, because as well as just using it as like a monetary thing, like a commission-based pricing model, or like a performance-based pricing model to gain more money in that moment, if you can say, hey, I'm a copywriter, and instead of just saying on your portfolio, I wrote this blog for Nike, take a look. You can put, I wrote this blog for Nike, which resulted in 7 million impressions on their website, which then resulted in a following like $4 million in revenue, and this, that, and the other. And then when people, because in my opinion, most stuff in business, no matter if you're 3D rendering or product design, I mean, the main aim of business is to make money. And no matter what field you're in, if when pitching to a client or talking to a client, you can always include the end goal of making money, and you understand the impact that your work has on the company's revenue. I think that helps so much in terms of the actual client acquisition. Whereas someone's just like, yeah, I can make a pretty graphic for you, and be like, whereas someone else is like, yeah, I can make this graphic for you for this target audience who usually tend to purchase these kind of products and in they like this style and blah, blah, blah. When you have like more data-driven arguments, basically. But yeah,
yeah, that's
see.
So that point you just made is super important, and a lot of really new freelancers don't have the experience to be able to do that, which is earlier when I was saying when you're just starting out, it can be really hard to do value pricing because you don't understand any of that stuff. You're still thinking like an employee of your old boss. You're not thinking like an entrepreneur, which is what you are now. So, you know, if you want to call yourself an entrepreneur or business owner or whatever it is, you're running a business now. And if you think like a business person, like you just described, you do think like a business person, then who happens to have some skills at doing whatever, you know, copywriting or conversion rate options, whatever the skills are, it doesn't matter. But you're also a business owner. So you can talk to another business owner at that level, and they're going to completely differentiate yourself from anybody else who's just like, yeah, I can make you some pretty graphics for social media. And that is just completely different. If they're like, oh, can you make us pretty graphics? And you're like, yeah, I make pretty graphics all day long, but what are you going to do with them after I give them to you? What happens next? What are you hoping will happen once I give them to you? And eventually, if you keep asking these questions, and it can take some drill down, it can take some time, just like you said, eventually they're going to get to money eventually, because that's where the business case is. You can even go past the money, and or sometimes you don't even have to go all the way to the money, but eventually you can get there. You could get as close as you want. It can become tedious if you're really far away from the money, if you're branding or way upstream. It can become really tedious to try and get them to be like, well, maybe it'll result in $1 million more business or whatever. But you do need to find a thing that they believe is going to contribute to the outcome they want. So you want to know what the outcome is. So it could be, we want our CTO to be perceived as a thought leader, or it could be, we want to improve the morale of our employees, or we want to attract more talent, or we want to attract more clients, like whatever the thing is that is like the big thing in their mind. And then you say, okay, how do you think the thing that I do is going to contribute to that, which I don't have control over? And you use the word impressions. When you were talking about, you know, you can say, oh, I wrote this piece and it got, you know, 1 million impressions, which led to 4 million sales downstream. If they tell you that they want impressions and you're like, why do you want impressions? And they say, we want an article from you. And you'll say, why? Because that'll give us impressions. Well, what do you want impressions for? Well, the last time we got a ton of impressions, it increased our sales by a factor of 4. So, ding, okay. And you might be very confident that you can dramatically increase their impressions. You have no control after that, but you believe that you can increase their impressions. And they told you that impressions are worth something to them because it's going to lead to money. In their mind, it's a sure thing. So then you can commit to that. Oh, I can definitely get you impressions. No problem there. So if you're sure, dear client, if you're sure that 1 million impressions is going to lead to 4 million in sales or something like that, something in the ballpark, we've got a deal.
I like that. And then even if it doesn't make that $4 million in revenue, you're trying to get yourself into a position where you're only taking accountability of something that you can actually do. Because on the other side of that, they could get the 1 million impressions again, and it result in no sales because of something further downstream, as you say. That's, yeah, exactly. No, yeah, I like, and that's a good piece of advice there as well. And then, but then you say, obviously you need to be a business person with business experience and a business mindset to put yourself in a position to be able to talk like this to potential clients. What are the first steps for beginner freelancers into transitioning into this business mindset?
Practice. So have conversations with everybody you can who runs a business, and just always be asking the question, how's business? So instead of like, hey, how's it going or whatever, like you go into the dry cleaner, how's business? You go to the coffee shop, how's business? Anywhere you go, any business owners that you can talk to, not clients, these are not prospects, these are not leads, anybody you can talk to that runs a business, ask them how's business, and try and get past that, oh, pretty good, you know, oh, wow, it seems super busy, you guys must be, you know, and just start talking like a business owner to other business owners. So you could do this just casually in your day-to-day life if you patronize small businesses, or you could get into a group of entrepreneurs or people or small business owners or big business owners if you've got those kinds of contacts. But and pretty quickly, you're going to find that revenue is really important. Pretty soon, you're going to find out that keeping costs low is pretty important. Pretty soon, you're going to find out about raising awareness in the marketplace about their products and services is pretty important. You know, it's not rocket science to think about the pieces of a business that are important to business owners. It's really payroll. If they have employees, payroll is like a giant nightmare. It can be something that keeps them up nights. So talk to anybody you know who runs a business. Just talk to them. How's business? What's your biggest challenge right now? I'm just curious. Like, what's the biggest thing that's on your mind? And of course, just read some basic business books. Like it's kind of old now, but I think it's a really good one. If you read The E-Myth by Michael Gerber, and it breaks down three personality types that exist inside of a small business, and, you know, entrepreneur, manager, and technician. And most people listening to this that are new are technicians, and they don't understand the mindset of the entrepreneur and the manager, and in fact might have quit their job because they think those two roles are useless. But it turns out those two roles are not useless. They're extremely important. That's how work shows up on your desk every Monday morning. So if you want to read a book, it's not even that long. It is a little old, so you're going to have to, you know, the examples are like a bakery, which is not what anybody listening to this runs, but I think you'll get the idea. I think it's that would be a good one to read. But just familiarize yourself with basic business concepts. You don't have to go get an MBA. Just read some business 101 books, and you'll start to get the lingo, so the language of a business owner, what things they care about.
Yeah, that's so true what you say about going as well to business events. Like, you can go on places like meetup.com, especially if you're in a big city. There's so many like small business events around town. Just going to network. Again, this is something that I just do naturally, that you've like light bulb moment for me again, like, oh my god, I actually do that. Like, everybody I speak to, I usually go straight to business. Like, it's just, I've always thought it's because it's something that I enjoy. Like, my girlfriend always moans at me, you always talk about work, you always talk about business. And I'm like, yeah, but I love it. Like, what's the problem? And it's like, me and my circle of friends, all business owners pretty much, all in freelancing and business, and it's all we talk about to each other. And so when I go to see other people, it's all I'm curious about. But I get called like there's a name in Spanish which is like somebody that talks about work all the time, and it's like, yeah, but I'm not talking about work, I'm curious, you know. And I guess this is what you're saying here, is people just need to adopt that curiosity mindset of like, how is business? I'm going to reverse I know you here and just ask that question to you. How is business?
Great. Yeah. It was weird. Like, the COVID years, I had some of my best years ever, which was very lucky. And that was pretty rare. I think, you know, the interview you referenced earlier, I have to do like podcasts and stuff like this to keep myself busier. Like, I almost, you know, that thing that you just described where you like to talk about business, yeah, well, so do I. But if you're only working like a couple hours a week, you're not talking about it. You're cleaning the garage and pushing your kids on the swings, which those are great too. But, you know, you start to feel like you're retired or something, and like nothing matters business-wise. I don't know. It doesn't feel... It's not the greatest. I'm not ready to feel retired, I guess, is my point. So So I try and set up interviews like this to talk to other people, maybe help get the word out. So people who are brand new and working like a dog, you know, especially if they're... there's sort of two problems I notice when people start out. One is they're working like a dog. They probably have like one or two whale clients and they're just super busy all the time. Or they are so it's like feast famine. So they're working like crazy, or they've got no business. They're dead. They don't know how they're going to pay their rent, and they're panicking. So the two different problems are, like, one is you're not getting enough leads. You have no pipeline. You're not doing any marketing. except for when you're desperate and then you spam everyone you know. And the other one is when you're just working too much, that's an hourly thing. That's because of hourly. So the idea would be to get to some other business model. And you don't have to do it all at once, but you can, in small ways, you can move to a newer business model that separates your time from money, and then you get your time back without losing money.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's cool as well that your business kind of boomed in COVID. Why do you think that was? Was it just because the work that you were doing was suitable to remote or like the conditions that COVID created?
Yeah, I think
for the workplace?
Yeah, I think so. If I had to guess, that's what it was, because I don't work with anybody in person. Most of the people I know I've never met in person. So yeah, all of my clients are remote, and I guess it was just a sector type of thing. Like where the kinds of people that I help, their businesses didn't go down because they were remote too, and their clients were remote. So I guess we were a little bit insulated from that.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I know a lot of people had a really hard time. You know, if you were working in food service or something, forget about it.
Yeah, definitely. How do you feel about that remote lifestyle now? Like you say that most of your clients you've never met. Does that ever bug you or get to you that you don't have these like in-person work connections? You can't say to like, you know, a client like, hey Mike, let's play golf at the weekend sort of thing, or is it fine just keeping that work life separate?
No, it's not like that. It's more like I just don't need a big circle of I'm just not that social, I guess. I mean, like my, I have one of my brothers, my brother Matt, he's very social. He has, you know, like just drop in parties, Friday night, porch party, stop by my house if you're in the area. It's just like open door policy type of person. When I was younger, you know, and I know a lot of your listeners are younger, I think having a sort of in-person workplace, that was definitely more attractive to me when I was that age. I'm like 54 or something now. I don't even know how old I am. But back then, that was my social life. You know, it was like that's where I met my wife, come to think of it. You know, so there's like in my 20s and 30s, I worked at my one and only corporate job. And it was like a country club, I mean, or something, or a nightclub during the day. It was like everybody was socialized. It wasn't, you know, this is years ago, I guess, but it's like people were flirty and they would end up dating, and it was very, very social. Mm-hmm. And if I was that age, I might, you know, if I was single and didn't have two kids and two dogs and a mortgage, then maybe, yeah, I would miss it. But, you know, I guess the stage of life thing. And I've never had a million friends. I have like a couple of very, very lifelong friends, and that was always sufficient for me.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of a similar personality type to you, then, where I've got just like a very close group of friends. We don't see each other that much, but I think for me, I live a very, you know, digital lifestyle where everything is remote. All colleagues, yeah. All clients, like I cannot remember the last time I had an in-person meeting. And that is sometimes a bit like isolating and a bit annoying. I try to then I always think to myself, like, okay, like let's host an in-person networking event this year. I'll invite all my clients to one place and we'll do this. And then I'm like, oh my God, so many things could go wrong. Like, it's going to be so expensive. Yeah. And then it's like, no, we just keep it as that. But yeah, I guess that's just, like a battle of our time in that remote work. But I guess as well, that's where the business meetups on meetup.com and places like that as well is great, you know, to find and fix, those sort of problems.
Another idea would be if you're talking about sort of socializing with other business owners, it doesn't have to be, you know, it certainly could be an online forum or mastermind. You could get in a mastermind or some sort of, you know, SB Small Business Association LinkedIn group or something, you know, and just spend some time in there talking to people and understanding people who are more experienced than you, understanding like what the concerns are running a chain of laundromats or something.
Yeah, that is very true, actually. There's a load of online communities as well, especially like a lot of people that even we do like host online masterclasses for beginner freelancers. There's a lot of Discord servers as well, which is super popular right now, which you can just jump in and spark up those conversations. Because as well, I think business owners, they do tend to have quite an ego as well. So when you ask them about their business, they're going to love it. They're going to tell you everything because they love talking about it most of the time. So that plays, and that plays quite to your advantage.
Yeah, but most people don't ask them about it, like their spouse or whatever. It's just they're over it. It's like, okay, I get it already. And they probably can't talk to their employees about it either if they have employees. So you're right. I agree. That's been my experience, is that you have a hard time shutting them up.
Yeah, exactly. Or start a podcast and invite them on, and then you can talk to them for a whole hour.
I was going to say the same thing.
Exactly. But speaking of podcasts as well, where can people go to check out your content?
Well, we talked a lot about value pricing today, so I'll send people to valuepricingbootcamp.com, and that'll redirect to a page on my website where you can take a short email mini course about some specific topics that are related to that. But yeah, if you just go to jonathanstark.com, there's a first time here section on my homepage that has a bunch of popular stuff for people that have never heard of me before. So that's a good place to start. But if you jump on my mailing list, then you'll have my email. It comes from my personal email, so you can just reply to any message, ask follow-up questions. We can start a conversation over email.
Ah, awesome. Love it. Well, I want to say I just looked over at the time now, and yeah, it's gone so quickly. Just, I love these podcasts because it's just so interesting, like diving in and getting to know, like getting to know you, getting to know your experiences. And I just want to say like a massive thank you for coming on the podcast today and sharing those experiences and giving advice to the audience today.
Hey, my pleasure. I love that people like you are out there trying to help this group of people. I know it's really hard getting started. There's a lot to learn, but so keep it up. Love it.
Cool. Thank you very much. And thank you everybody for listening. And remember to subscribe whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on. And you can head over to 100kfreelanceclub.com and sign up for all of our free additional content on freelancing. But yeah, one last thank you to everybody, and we'll catch you in the next episode of the podcast.